And with that, I will now turn it over to Dr. Michelle Heacock, Director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, for opening remarks. Michelle, whenever you're ready.
All right, thanks so much, Molly, and good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us for today's webinar. As Molly mentioned, my name is Michelle Heacock, and I'm the director of the NIHS Superfund Research Program, or SRP. So I'd like to welcome you to this series, From Cells to Solutions, Emerging Tools for Studying Human Health and Disease. And this is hosted by the NIEHS, National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, Superfund Research Program, or SRP. From this snapshot you're seeing of the three sessions, you can see the series is designed to highlight technologies that can expand the researcher's toolbox to uncover human-relevant mechanistic insights that can be used to improve predictive toxicology and inform and refine risk assessment frameworks. So this is the first session on your series, the most leftmost box. And we have two more webinars, the next two boxes that are coming up later this month, the 16th and 21st. More information and links to register are available in the link that's provided on the top right of that side. And I think, Molly, you might be entering some of these links through the chat too. So, because the Superfund Research Program, or SRP, might be new to some of the audience members, I just wanted to give you some context for our program. SRP is a federally funded program that's administered by the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, or NIHS, which is located in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. We are an institute of the National Institutes of Health, which is predominantly located in Bethesda, Maryland. If you wanted to learn more about our program, I invite you to watch our overview video. There's a QR code in the bottom right or a link, whatever's easier. It's a nice video that describes the program and its impact. So what is the SRP? The SRP fosters multidisciplinary research and innovative strategies. It's focused on providing solutions to problems associated with exposure to hazardous substances. When the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act of 1986 created the SRP, it established broad mandates for SRP to pursue within, for the NIHS to pursue within the SRP. If you had a chance to look at the three sessions in detail, you'll see that we're covering a wide range of disciplines, and that's because our program is driven by the mandates that you see listed here. And just briefly, the mandates are to advance our ability to detect, assess, and evaluate the health effects of disease risks posed by exposure to hazardous substances, to detect hazardous substances in the environment, and importantly, to develop strategies to reduce the amount and toxicity of hazardous substances. So to address these mandates and tackle the complexity of environmental health challenges, which includes things like how people are exposed and how this manifests into a health effect, you can appreciate working towards practical, real-world solutions to reduce exposures to hazardous substances requires a comprehensive understanding of the problem. So I confess this graphic grossly simplifies the complexity. We're simply showing this to illustrate that SRP grant recipients, who you'll hear from over this series, are not only working to understand how and why exposures are leading to health effects and how to reduce exposures from happening in the first place, they're also incorporating other data points like collaborations with affected communities so that practical real-world solutions for both current and emerging environmental health problems can be developed. So this series is focusing on biomedical research. I've got a red arrow there, but I should also have one to data science approaches. And together they're helping us understand questions that were previously difficult or maybe in some cases impossible to address. It will highlight the growing availability of technologies that can be used to facilitate and accelerate our understanding of human health relevance by more accurately reflecting human biological responses with the goal of strengthening the scientific foundation for public health protection. So the webinar series will highlight how these emerging tools are being developed and applied to, and you see these in each of these, next slide, please, Molly. You see these in the four boxes. So to uncover mechanistic insights into how chemicals interact with biological systems to improve predictive toxicology for human health outcomes, refine and modernize risk assessment frameworks, and ultimately expand the research toolbox available to scientists working to reduce the burden of hazardous substances on communities. So by integrating cell-based assays, computational tools, and other innovative methodologies, we're taking meaningful steps toward a more holistic understanding of environmental health and toward more effective strategies for exposure mitigation and human health protection. This is the motivation behind the series to showcase progress, to spark collaboration, and to support continuing innovation. And while we're certainly making strides, there's still more important work ahead. The series is designed to help us collectively explore what's possible and identify where further advances might be needed. The efforts also align with broader momentum across the NIH, including recent initiatives emphasizing the importance of human-based research technologies to help set the stage. For example, our first speaker today will introduce this broader NIH perspective and share insight from a key NIH Common Fund initiative to address this, to address these initiatives. Sorry about that. So with that, I want to turn it over to our moderator, Dr. Christopher Duncan, who is my colleague and a health scientist administrator from a NIHS, who oversees in part a grant portfolio that includes data science, and he will introduce our first speaker. So thank you again for joining us. And Chris, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you to everyone online for joining today. As Michelle mentioned, my name is Chris Duncan. I'm a program administrator at the NIHS Division of Extramural Research and Training, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. We have four excellent speakers today, each highlighting work related to the use of innovative, human-relevant technologies to better characterize biological effects of chemicals. So as a reminder, we very much welcome your questions for our speakers today. So if you do have a question, please use the Q&A feature. And we'll do our best to address as many of those as we can after each presentation. It's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker today, Dr. Margaret Ohojinska. Margaret is a program director in the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination, where she oversees efforts on re-engineering the research enterprise. Margaret is the program leader for the NIH Common Fund's Complement Animal Research and Experimentation, or Complementary, program. And today she'll introduce the Complementary program efforts to accelerate the development, standardization, validation, and use of human-based NAMs. Welcome, Margaret. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
And see my slides. Yes.
Yes, they look great.
Thank you so much. So thank you for that introduction, Chris. And I want to thank the meeting organizers for the opportunity to talk to you today about the complementary program that is quite relevant, as was explained, to the SRP program. So very happy to present and take any of your questions or take them offline after as well. So the complementary program, as was described, stands for Complement Animal Research and Experimentation. And I am in the Common Fund space, which is the Office of Strategic Coordination. And so I'll first start with a little bit of a background about Common Fund and then move into the program description and the various initiatives, as well as a current open funding opportunity that may be of interest to this research community. Next slide, just a moment. All right, so here we are. I'm just showing you the background about the Common Fund program. So in 2004, the NIH Roadmap was launched, which was the original name for Common Fund. And when Congress unanimously reauthorized the NIH, it established a Division of Program Coordination, Planning, and Strategic Initiatives, or DPCIPSI, within the Office of Director, and the NIH Common Fund to provide a dedicated source of funding to enable trans-NIH research. Prior to this, most programs were co-funded across the institutes and centers if they were relevant to more than one institute. And here, it offered a set-aside funds for some programs to be developed across the ICs that have relevance to more than several of them. And essentially, the mission of the Common Fund is to support bold scientific programs to catalyze discovery across all biomedical and behavioral research, to advance areas of biomedical and behavioral research important to the missions of multiple NIH institutes and centers, and to spur subsequent biomedical advances that otherwise would not be possible without an initial strategic investment. And essentially, the features of these activities to catalyze biomedical discovery is to accelerate emerging science, to remove research roadblocks, to enhance the research workforce, as well as support high-risk, high-reward science. And really, it's to make a substantial investment in a time-limited, goal-driven program with milestones for several program components, such as within the complementary program. And essentially, these are meant to be collaborative, including scientists from diverse disciplines to provide input as we plan the program. So there was an extensive strategic planning effort to stand up the complementary program, which was actually co-led by NCATS and NIEHS, and now includes more than 27 institute centers and offices across NIH. This collaborative program also involves researchers participating in interdisciplinary consortia to tackle shared goals, as well as involving leadership and staff from across all of the institute centers and offices involved in the program to facilitate working together to design funding opportunities and oversee the projects that come out of the program. The complementary program strategic planning efforts started back in 2023-24. And the purpose and goal of this program is to catalyze the development, standardization, validation, and use of human-based new approach methodologies that will transform the way we do basic translational and clinical sciences. The major goals of the program are to better model and understand human health and disease outcomes across patient populations, to develop NAMs that provide insight into specific biological processes or disease states, to validate mature NAMs to support regulatory use and standardization, as well as to complement traditional models and make biomedical research more efficient and effective. And I'm also including a QR code that will take you directly to the complementary website that has additional information about each of the components and the current funding opportunities. So essentially, the overarching program goals are to develop NAMs that incorporate the following features: complex in vitro models, emulating patient variability, in silico multi-scale systems, simulating healthy diseased individuals, in chemical cell-free systems, capturing dynamic changes, as well as combinatorial NAMs that integrate FAIR data sets and AI engines for all NAMs. So it is creating a comprehensive solution suite for various context of use. Essentially, we wanted to highlight that this builds on activities across NIH that have been developed over many years, including development of digital twin models, in silico models, complex in vitro systems, and in chemical screening. So you may recognize the TOX21 program, which is also involves NIEHS, as well as the in vitro systems. And here, the purpose of the complementary program is to integrate these solutions into a complementary approach, utilizing the combinatorial NAM solution to include two or more of these systems for potential improved development of these new approach methodologies and approaches. So thus far, as I mentioned, actually it's now 27 NIH institute centers and offices. The complementary program is focused on human-based NAMs, and to date, we have completed several strategic planning activities, including listening sessions, an interagency retreat, and a landscape analysis that was in 2024. We also launched a prize, an ideation prize competition, that awarded made awards to 20 teams initially during our strategic planning phase. We also have recently, this past year, launched the Validation Qualification Network, which is a public-private partnership with the Foundation for NIH. And the design phase of this partnership is underway, with more than 50 public, industry, and nonprofit partners joining to date. We currently have a Reduction to Practice NAMS challenge that was launched last fall. So the submissions are open, and the submission due date is March 1st. I will have a separate slide on more details about this challenge, but it is open funding opportunity right now. We are also anticipating the launch of two major components of the program, including the Technology Development Centers and the NAMS Data Hub and Coordinating Center. The Technology Development Centers funding opportunity is managed through NCATS, and the NAMS Data Hub and Coordinating Center is managed through NIEHS, under the supervision of Chris Duncan, the fearless leader. And here, I also wanted to point out that we have established MOUs with several federal partners. NIH and FDA have established an MOU to collaborate and coordinate efforts in the NAMS space, providing regulatory expertise. FDA will provide the support to the projects within the complementary program. We will also plan to hold regular joint NIH FDA workshops and meetings to ensure progress and goals and to develop new policies and initiatives as needed, and engaging in activities to promote development, adoption, and uptake of NAMs that may have applicability for FDA regulatory use. We actually also have a similar MOU established with the EPA. So we are one of the key features of complementary is it's reaching across the aisle between the toxicological space and biomedical engineering space, to allow for conversations with regulatory stakeholders, including both FDA and EPA. So here is a broad snapshot of the various components of the program. These include the technology development centers that I mentioned to stimulate the development of NAMs and to fill the areas of greatest need, with emphasis on increased biological complexity and throughput, innovative approaches, and data sharing. We also have the NAMS Data Hub and Coordinating Center, or the NDHCC, which is meant to create integrated, facilitate creation of integrated data structures, including standards for model credibility to improve fairness of NAM-relevant data and to create a NAMS, searchable NAMS repository. The third major pillar of the program is the Validation Qualification Network for NAMS adoption implementation. And this is really a multi-stakeholder public-private partnership to establish common data elements and standardized reporting to apply validation qualification frameworks and to accelerate deployment and regulatory implementation of NAMs. And all of these components include a community engagement and training feature to promote the development of a comprehensive biomedical research workforce to build and use NAMs, community engagement, active end user engagement to make sure whatever we build is going to be utilized and leveraged and adopted, and including societal and ethical considerations within the NAMs space. We also, as I mentioned, had two prize competitions. One was the ideation prize that we had in 2024, and the current open reduction to practice challenge that is open and on the street right now. Next slide, just a moment. So the Complementary Consortium, just for those visual learners out there, is composed of the technology development centers that are complex multi-component centers, which we are using the UN1 mechanism. The NAMS Data Hub and Coordinating Center is using the U24 mechanism, so these are cooperative agreements. And we also have the Validation and Qualification Network that has multiple stakeholders, including regulatory partners, industry partners, the Interagency Committee for Validation of Alternative Test Methods, that includes multiple federal agencies. I believe it's 18 agencies at the moment. It also includes nonprofits and other end users. And really, we wanted to create a seamless workflow from stakeholder engagement to implementation, and keeping training, community engagement, and workforce development as a substrate to ensure success. And this program, the other feature of the Common Fund program, is it allows for a longer time scale. So we have a 5-year initial stage, followed by a potential additional 5 years, so across 10 years of life cycle. So now I'll tell you a little bit more about the Validation Qualification Network. So as I mentioned, NIH has partnered with the Foundation for NIH to establish this network as a public-private partnership. The goals are to accelerate the implementation and adoption of NAMs in research and regulatory contexts by ensuring NAMs are robust, reliable, and reproducible, to demonstrate biological relevance and establish confidence in NAMs to ensure that NAMs are fit for purpose. And this is going to be utilizing a multi-pronged approach across the various stakeholders managing the project to establish common data elements and standardized reporting to ensure NAMs have well-described protocols to design and fine transferability studies and to conduct quality assessment. So to date, we have, as I mentioned, more than 50 participating organizations, including 20 public ones and 40 private, and this number is growing. We have major steering committee co-chairs. The public sector co-chair is Dr. Warren Casey, who's the executive director of the Interagency Committee for Validation of Alternate Methods, as well as Stepan Baran from the private sector, who is the vice president of the 3Rs Collaborative. And the steering committee has been meeting regularly to develop work plans and work streams as part of the design phase of this network. The FNIH has also recently invited the scientific community to submit project concepts to build scientific confidence in human-based NAMs, and there was a request for proposals or RFI for this, so you can see that for your reference. And the VQN will be selecting up to 8 NAM concept to serve as foundational pilot projects for in the pre-competitive space. To learn more about this partnership, I'm also including a link. And so essentially, really, the value add for this public-private partnership is to bring together, have a vehicle to allow for conversations across all of the stakeholder communities, to discuss pre-competitive data sharing and funding validation studies for these integrated platforms and to synergize and coordinate across the network and beyond. And so again, this network is focusing, and the program is focusing on novel combinatorial NAMs for regulatory and pre-regulatory use, cost sharing with NIH and the private sector to allow for these validation studies to take place, as well as to have these opportunities for a pre-competitive space for establishing consensus validation qualification frameworks, and to build upon and accelerate the existing efforts for creating more cost-effective, human-relevant, translational, and rapid approaches to bring them to market and adoption. So the VQN timeline includes what I mentioned, the design phase to plan and develop the network. So we are currently in the design phase, and this year we are transitioning to the implementation phase, with the FNIH taking the lead in coordinating the various work streams within this network and to support the validation studies of specific use cases from the outside community, as well as then supporting use cases that come out of the Technology Development Center. So as I mentioned, this was going to take 5 years with a transition, potential transition for an additional 5 years. And so here is just a snapshot of the current partners across the federal family. You can see there are not only domestic partners, but we also have international groups that have joined the network because we are really thinking about global harmonization and ensuring that developments across the globe can be harmonized and leveraged for the best outcomes. And here we also have private sector partners listed that are current, and there's additional ones joining as well, but it includes various stakeholders across industry and nonprofits. And so we're very happy to have a very lively group and lots of discussions and input. We also, last thing I wanted to share is the Complementary NAMs Reduction to Practice Challenge. So this is inviting innovative solvers to provide solutions to successfully demonstrate implementation of integrated human-based solutions in a practical, usable form within a 3-year period. So there are three phases. Phase one is for proof of concept and feasibility studies. Phase two is for prototype development and milestone achievements. And three for prototype delivery for validation qualification into the VQN. So aside from the cash prize, there will also be the opportunity to work within the VQN towards validation and qualification of a particular context of use. And so the deadline, the current deadline, is March 1st. And here's the QR code for more information to accept the challenge and to also for any questions you may have. And here's a visual of these phases. So again, open call for solutions, proof of concept within the first phase, and then leading on to the next phase, which will be milestone driven, including construction, scaling, and performance testing, deliverables that will be evaluated for consideration for getting the cash awards for the next phase. Milestone two is internal validation, reproducibility, and data submission. And then the delivery and validation section here for we will consider up to three runner-up and one grand prize winner of $1 million receiving, and for delivery to the VQN for independent testing. So this is our overall schematic. And we also have additional information I can share post-meeting about FAQs that we have developed around this challenge. So I think this is my last slide. It's really the complementary program and other activities at NIH are really aiming to cover the NAMS confidence continuum from building confidence in biomedical research approaches and NAMS being developed there to validation and qualification to regulatory implementation. So we are really hoping to be supportive across this spectrum and to do to facilitate handoffs from one stage to the next. So I think with that, I wanted to thank everyone for the opportunity to present, and if there's time, I'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Margaret. That's a great presentation and highlight the many exciting ongoing efforts underway for the complementary program. So we do have a few minutes for any questions. So please feel free to submit your questions for Margaret into the Q&A box. So perhaps I'll start with a question, maybe going back to a little bit of the basics for NAMS. So could you comment on your thoughts on the rationale for developing alternatives to animal research?
Yes, thank you very much for that question. So essentially, that goes back to the goal of the complementary program. So I'll just go right back up to that slide, if I may, so others can see it as well. So essentially, the reason that we're considering alternatives is that while we have a lot of great models developed thus far, it's really to expand the toolbox. So the thought is that these human-based new approach methodologies may improve approaches for us to in terms of efficacy and toxicity testing in the human model to be more relevant to the human model. So some models that are currently developed in the animal may be useful to a certain extent, but we want to sort of expand on that toolbox to complement those models to become more efficient and effective, perhaps to reduce the time, reduce the R&D costs associated, as well as the timelines associated with getting these to market.
Great. And in regards to getting these to market, what are the impacts here? What do you think will the validated non-animal models improve the approval timelines for these emerging technologies?
That is one of our aims, is to improve the approval timelines by streamlining the frameworks required between the research landscape and the regulatory landscape. There's currently a lot of back and forth for each particular project, but understanding the overall flow, that's why we established this very close relationship with the FDA in terms of the MOU to get that feedback for particular NAMs that would be relevant for the FDA workstream for regulatory approvals, but also with the EPA for other regulatory paths that would be relevant for those contexts of use cases, for those use cases. So it's really not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but it's sort of streamlining the wheel and the path with which the car is traveling, the complementary bus. Yes.
Great. Thank you so much, Margaret. Once again, please add any questions to the Q&A box. But let's see, not seeing any additional questions. Perhaps we can thank you again, Margaret, for your presentation, and we can move on to our next speaker for today. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Brian Johnson. Brian is an assistant professor in the departments of pharmacology and toxicology, and also biomedical engineering at Michigan State University. His interdisciplinary research lab specializes in the design, manufacturing, automation, and testing of human-derived models of development and disease to study intercellular signaling. So today, Dr. Johnson will be discussing his work on combinatorial new approach methods, or NAMs, to elucidate mechanisms of human thyroid hormone disruption by legacy and emerging chemical contaminants. Welcome, Brian. Please feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Chris. thank you for that great introduction. To Margaret for the introduction to some of the NAMs and some of the concepts that we'll be discussing today. So the title of these sessions was Cells to Solutions. And so, the cell part, I think, is easy for us to imagine. The solutions part, I think, in thinking about that, I looked at the demographics of the people who are registered for the webinar, and we see people in academia, in regulatory, in consulting. And so those solutions really, I think we need to appreciate that they're very different based on where we come from. And so I'm hoping that in my talk today that we have something a little bit for everyone in each one of those systems. I do have a conflict of interest to declare. Some of the technology that we've invented that's funded by the federal government, we've translated out to try to make available as technology to the community. So one of the overarching things that I really want to cover today and get to is how can we leverage some of these new approach methods to inform how environmental contaminants here cause thyroid imbalance and effects in humans. And I will say, you know, I was an awardee, and I'm grateful to the complimentary program on some of that. But I think the idea of combinatorial NAMs is still emerging, and we don't quite have, not everyone has a great grasp of it. And so what is that? So when I think of combinatorial NAMs, I think of how we can use in silico and in vitro, in chemical, in all these models together and how they can work together to inform sort of that the whole is greater than the individual parts. And so we'll use adverse outcome pathway modeling, not just to map things out, but also to assess the confidence and the knowledge we have in a given system. We'll integrate physiologically based kinetic modeling to understand how drugs and chemicals move through the body, as well as in vitro to in vivo extrapolation to understand how those effects might affect human populations. And my sort of bread and butter, what our lab really works on is how to design complex in vitro models that are really practical and usable. And then most importantly, what I hope you can appreciate today is that these models work back and forth with one another to inform each other and to improve the overall whole. So I want to give you a brief introduction on thyroid hormone system to understand the basic biology. And so I'm having issues with my advance here. Thyroid hormones, T3 and T4, differ by one iodine. T4 is sort of a promolecule, and T3 is the bioactive compound that is driving transcription in the receptor. But those levels occur systemically in the blood. And so we have thyroid hormones in the blood. When those levels get low, we have a circuit in the hypothalamus that senses that, causes the pituitary gland to release thyroid-stimulating hormone, causing the thyroid gland to manufacture to make more T4 and some T3 released into the blood and in the serum. That goes through the blood, and really one of the major organs that changes its kinetics is the liver, where it's metabolized. T4 is taken to T3 or to an inactive RT3 phase one and two conjugation activities, and that's thyroid hormone kinetics. Now, what differs in thyroid hormone action is what the molecules are actually doing physiologically, and that's really shown here over on the right. And broadly speaking, these molecules are controlling aspects, important aspects of cellular energy metabolism in cells and organs throughout the body. And they do it in a way that separates. So the organ system sort of is using thyroid hormone action to independently regulate energy metabolism from the systemic circulation. So these two processes work in concert with one another, and they're important to environmental toxicology. The reason is that many, many compounds disrupt thyroid hormone signaling. So if we think about the Superfund research compounds, if we think of legacy chemicals like the PCBs, dioxins, organic chlorine pesticides, as well as emerging compounds like PFAS, PBDEs, even current use pesticides, many, many compounds show adverse effects in animal models on the thyroid pathway. One way they do that is through activation of xenobiotic receptors, shown here, CAR-PXR and the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. Our Superfund research program studies mostly dioxin-like compounds, which bind the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, as well as mixtures. And so what happens in this case is that these enzymes induce glucuronosyl transferases, which glucuronidate T3 and T4, decreasing the serum levels of these compounds. So that's the kinetics. We can measure that in blood. Depending on the species, the life stage, the tissue we're in, those decreases in serum levels can cause changes in thyroid hormone action, which will result in things like thyroid cancer, developmental defects in memory, learning, hearing, and vision, cardiovascular, and other metabolic disorders. Now, what's important to know in the regulatory community is that our animal models are much better at activating these glucuronosyl transferases than humans. And so it's been argued that this mechanism is not necessarily human relevant because it happens much more in the animal system. However, I want to bring your attention to, you know, we often think about adverse outcome pathways as this sort of just simple molecular look. But the second part of it is really a weight of evidence assessment on how good our knowledge is at, yes, these molecular initiating events, but also the important intermediate events that occur. And if we do that sort of evidence-based analysis, we run into trouble. And so it's been shown that rats that don't glucuronidate, gun rats, actually, so they're not able to do glucuronidation. And if we block this, then we should be able to block this entire sequence. However, rats that don't glucuronidate still show significant drops in serum T4 with no changes in glucuronidation, suggesting that this mechanism is at least incomplete and if anything, incorrect. So we can use the AOP to understand what these mechanisms are and try to better inform our system. The other thing that we use AOPs for is to try to understand what components we should model in our in vitro systems. And so the thyroid signaling is very unique compared to other endocrine disrupting things like estrogens and androgens that are limited in the number of molecular sites that are targeted. Thyroid disruption can happen at molecular initiating events in the liver, molecular initiating events in the thyroid gland itself, in the serum, as well as in the peripheral tissues. And so because so many different areas can be impacted, it's more important to have complex and more robust physiological modeling. What our overarching hypothesis is that these initiating events, yes, change hormone kinetics, but that the intermediate events here, where these different pathways can converge, are probably more important to model, because likely if you have either compounds that work through multiple molecular initiating events or chemical mixtures that work through initiating events, likely will have convergence in these intermediate pathways. And we think that they can predict across tissues. So the other thing we use adverse outcome pathways for is to identify what critical endpoints we want to measure. And so we want to measure our thyroid hormones themselves, to measure thyroid hormone kinetics, both the hormones and their phase two metabolites. And we also want markers of thyroid hormone action. And so, again, we look at the metabolic drivers that thyroid hormone receptor drives in the liver. So, for example, lipid uptake, cholesterol biosynthesis, mitochondrial membrane potential, et cetera. And so one last point I want to make here is it's known that thyroid hormone signaling drives and regulates these processes. It's also known that many chemicals also directly or through their own cognate receptors modify these processes. And so again, I think it's an important place in an intermediate event to model and understand chemical toxicity. So moving to the in vitro model that we use, this is a microplate-based system that we invented, actually funded by the EPA STAR program about a decade ago. We've patented this and translated it into a company. The technology itself is very simple. So it's a standard microplate. However, the unique thing is that we've got a microchannel cut between pairs of wells. So here you see one cell type in one column of the plate. In the adjacent column, you see a different cell type. You see them in their own media. They can set here, they can form spheroids or do whatever they need to do in their own media. When you're ready, whether it be on day zero or on day 10, you can merge these liquids simply by adding liquid. And now the soluble factors can diffuse back and forth and signal between these different cell types. So one of the best aspects, I think, or the most useful aspects of the technology is that it's plug and play. And so if we're building an in vitro model, we don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel. We can look at the literature and identify the best human hepatocyte models that exist in 2D or 3D. we can find the best thyrocyte models that exist and then combine them in this system so we don't have to do that independent development. And so the as you probably all know from liver, there are probably 100 different hepatocyte models, and they're all the best. and so that's an area of challenge, but there are far fewer validated thyrocyte models. And so we started here and asked if we could adopt this technology. So Chad Diesenroth and his group at the US EPA have done a lot of work publishing and validating a thyrocyte, primary human thyrocyte assay. We adopted that assay in, ran density experiments in our microplates, and showed that if we dose with thyroid stimulating hormone, in fact, these thyrocytes can increase in number and proliferate. The interesting thing about thyroid is that thyroid hormone isn't actually formed within the cell. It's formed within a thyroid follicle in a lumen of a group of cells. And so forming these 3D structures is vitally important. When we do form those structures, if we look at some of our higher densities, we actually are able to stimulate with thyroid stimulating hormone and get higher levels of T4 production that we can antagonize with chemicals that disrupt thyroid hormone synthesis. We also, in preliminary studies, see some effects with TCDD, which had been reported before. And so we're excited about that model. And so these early studies gave us confidence that we can adopt and use this model, and that it's a good one to assist. Moving to the human hepatocyte model now, we wanted to understand what endpoints we could work with. And so our initial studies were to identify biomedical endpoints that we could use to validate or to select the hepatocyte model that was optimal for our biology. So one of our favorite endpoints to use in complex in vitro models is high content imaging. Here we've got nuclei in blue, fatty acid uptake in green, mitochondrial membrane potential in red, and total mitochondria in fuchsia. And one of the benefits is getting beautiful images like this. However, what we're really trying to do is to mimic and model all of these different aspects of thyroid hormone action. And we don't want to do it in a single well, a single picture. We need to do this in high throughput and reproducibly. And as you can see, we've got a very robust assay where if you separate these different channels out, and here we've got a plate where we've done a TCDD dose response. And we can see that mitochondrial membrane potential in this system is exquisitely sensitive to dioxin response, where we've got picomolar reductions in this fluorescent signal. So of course we need to quantify this. And so we use cell segmentation of these images to identify nuclei, cell body, to link those together so that we can quantify each individual cell and really start to feed things like machine learning and other really data intensive and data rich methods. For the remainder of the talk, we're simply using much simpler methods, which are taking these individual cell numbers and averaging them out, but we've got a depth of information to mine in future experiments. So when we look at that, this is a dose response curve that was based on TCDD, as you saw in that last image. We work with our different project in our Superfund Center that looks at dechlorination byproducts in our Superfund research area, which is the Tittabawassee River in Michigan. And what's interesting is some of these dechlorination products have different binding affinities for the AHR. And so we reflect that in our assay with high affinity, moderate affinity, and low affinity dioxins showing a nice dose response. We can collaborate that by using, again, in the same assay, in the same model, we can measure things like a P450 activity using a Promega CYP21 glow. And show those same dose response curves. We've also integrated things like an in situ ethoxyresorufin assay, which again measures CYP1A1 activity, where we can see both sort of broad levels, but also which cells actually in our organoids or spheroids or 2D are expressing high levels of P450. One last thing I wanted to point out was just that actually, our mitochondrial membrane potential assay was about fivefold more sensitive than our CYP1A1 assay, which is really the prototypic assay for this, indicating these intermediate events are good and sensitive targets to model. We're, as I said earlier, we're not only interested in dioxins, but we look at other compounds and how these mixtures might have effects in these systems. And so we measured a number of different PFAS compounds, and we looked at PFOS, and we see our dose response here in the same plate with TCDD shown in the bottom. But if we do a dose response of PFOS in the top, we actually see the opposite effect, where TCDD decreases mitochondrial membrane potential, PFOS increases it, and we see the same in lipid uptake. And so TCDD decreases lipid uptake in our cells, whereas PFOS increases it. I will say we're also doing cytotoxicity and other measurements to make sure there aren't other confounding factors, and there's no cytotoxicity in these assays. Unfortunately, in a simple 2D assay, we don't get responsiveness to thyroid hormones themselves. And so while we can use compounds like TCDD or FCCP that are disrupting mitochondria, either thyroid hormone receptor antagonists or thyroids themselves are not really changing these assays too much. And this has been known that you really need three-dimensional systems or more complex systems to get that activity. And so for that, we've moved to 3D spheroids. The other thing we've done is increased our throughput capacity. So we went from a 96 well to a 3D 4 well plate. You can see really good rigor and reproducibility across these. So again, we've got dose response of T3, T4, dioxin, PFOS, and rifampicin. We can quantify all of these points and see dose response increases in T3, dose response decreases in TCDD, rifampicin, et cetera. And so it's a very rich assay for us. Again, the primary thing, we're trying to model what's happening in human populations, and cell lines are great, but you know they don't represent the human biology that we're interested in. And so while we can engineer cells and systems that will tell us this, we're more interested in trying to find ways to do this with primary cell types. And so we've adopted primary cells from different donors from either the same assay and the same vendor. We've identified or used hepatocytes from a different vendor using their own separate protocols. We've used quad cultures using primary hepatocytes as well as non-parenchymal cells. We've used the HepaSH system that uses primary hepatocytes that have been passed through a mouse host. And so all of these systems we're evaluating for our thyroid hormone kinetics, thyroid hormone action. I'm not quite ready to share the data on thyroid hormone action. I will show you just the inducibility of these enzymes using our different cytochrome P450s or rifampicin, showing increases in P450. Not as exciting in our quad cultures, made us a little bit sad, but we're still working through some of those. The HepSH model wasn't as great, and then our cell lines. And so we found is that we can culture all these models in our systems. And we really, because we've got that kind of throughput, we can do so many different validations, variations, dose response curves. And I think this is one of the most important things in complex in vitro modeling, having the ability to measure a lot of things to optimize and to validate a system. Finally, in parallel, we've been developing the kinetic assay. And so we've restricted ourselves to use just 100 microliters of media. So in a 3D4 well, we'll have to merge three different wells or pool them to run an assay. But doing that, we've been able to detect all of the compounds, the parent T3, T4, the glucuronide metabolites, the sulfotransferase metabolites in that system. And so moving forward, we're very excited about being able to use this data to understand how these chemicals are changing the ratios of thyroid hormone metabolites. So now that we've identified our plug-and-play systems, so I will say we've done the primaries. There's one more complex in vitro system we'd like to incorporate, which is LifeNet's TruVivo system. So as we're working on that, though, we've got a valid system, at least, that we could try and see if they work in concert. And so what we did is we put thyrocytes in co-culture with hepatocytes and then did a dose response curve, or again, induced with TSH, and showed that in monoculture, we can induce with TSH and show thyroid hormone or thyrocyte proliferation. And when they're in co-culture, we see the same effect. And so I think we should think this shows functional integration of our monocultures in this system. And the exciting thing is that we still provide the individual model strengths, like high content imaging, being able to look at thyroid hormone dynamics in each of these cell lines. So on the last point I want to make, coming back, so now we've generated, we've got tools that we can identify the flux, the rates of change in thyroid hormones, and their metabolites in our systems. Now, how do we turn that into actionable things that affect human health? And for that, we work with our collaborators at Emory University, Cheng Zhang, who runs the computational modeling core in our P42 center. He's developed a physiologically based kinetic model that basically identifies compartments in the body and maps out the rates and how these molecules will move through these different compartments. Once we have that model now, we can take any of those rates. And so the rate of thyroid stimulating hormone binding to thyrocytes. And we can model what would happen if we have a change. And so if in our in vitro system, we identify a 25% reduction in this endpoint, we can map out now using data populated from the NHANES study on what human population levels of thyroid hormones look like in TSH and then free T4. And that's in blue. So this is the normal human situation in about 10,000 individuals. And now if we can apply this PBK model, apply these rate changes, and even incorporating things like homeostatic feedback in the brain, we can identify how a human population would shift based on that change that we've detected in our in vitro system. And so I think this is a fantastic way and a very powerful tool for us to understand what the actual effects of our in vitro findings are in vivo in human populations. So overall, I hoped to convince you that combining some of these NAMs in a combinatorial way is a powerful framework for predicting chemical disruption, and particularly here, thyroid disruption. I hope to convince you that scalability and sort of low cost per replicate is really important in validating these systems and identifying good molecular endpoints. And that I think these integrated approaches are a blueprint for future new approach methods that we can use for other biologies. There's some references, and I really want to thank the people in the lab who've done the work. Kerry Gardner, Sungying Wang, and Sophia Karen did a lot of the cell work. Zhaping Chen did the mass spec work. The Superfund Center to support this research is very exciting and a great fun place to be. Cheng Zhang at Emory and Max Baga, who's done a lot of the work on the computation. Chad Deisenroth, who's worked to translate his model, as well as Ed LeCluse and Ada Rogers on the primary thyrocytes. And then especially our funding for the Superfund research program. You know, I think this is vitally important research, and we're very grateful to have that program. I've also received funding in a K99R00 from NIHS. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you so much, Brian, for your presentation and for highlighting your integrated NAMS approach for predicting thyroid disruption. We do have time for a few questions, so please feel free to add your questions to the Q&A box. Let's see. Maybe we'll start off with a question here, Brian. So how can understanding the mechanisms and risk for legacy chemicals inform our approach to emerging chemicals like PFAS?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. I think we're always tempted, especially in academia, to move to the new shiny thing, right? we've spent so much money and time on TCDD, on PCBs, yet we still don't know mechanisms. But we do know how these things have moved in populations. We've got huge tools, great tools to understand these. And so by understanding how those legacy chemicals work, I think we can better predict and prepare ourselves to understand how to deal with emerging contaminants like PFAS and other things.
Great, thank you. And regarding multiple chemicals, so what does the evidence suggest about the effects of multiple chemical exposures on thyroid function?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So there was a study in the early 2000s that in animal models gave individual doses of thyroid disrupting chemicals and then gave them in combination and actually showed synergism where the individual compounds did not predict. So thyroid is so unique. You know, PTU that we showed has different mechanisms of action in the thyroidocytes in themselves and in the hepatocytes. TCDD likely has different mechanisms of action in each one. And so I think, you know, this system, if we're gonna validate either, you know, simple NAMs versus more complex ones, I think this is a great system to do that in. I do have one question in my Q&A. I think maybe it's from somebody else, so we're not seeing it, but it was, you showed the quad culture spheroid didn't perform as you expected. Can you talk a little bit about why it didn't? Yeah, I don't know necessarily. I will say these metabolic markers are extraordinarily sensitive to the environment. And so I think the amount of oxygenation in your culture media, all of these things are quite sensitive. And so hepatocytes themselves, we think of a cell system like this in a controlled environment, and everything is the same. However, you know, these in vitro and in vivo, they're dynamic. The liver can change based on the metabolic state of the individual. And I think the cultures can change based on the metabolic state of that culture. I think we might be able to find conditions that they were better, but in that particular one, they weren't.
Great. Thank you, Brian. And there's a technical question here for you. What AI imaging tools are you using to segment cells? Setting thresholds is incredibly tricky. And one of the participants is curious whether which tools you're using to face that challenge.
Yeah, so our high content imager is a CQ1 by Yokogawa, and they have a cell pathfinder software that goes with that we use. We have used AI tools and cell profiler, right, which is publicly available, to be able to do that segmentation. Because we've got our pipeline built through, you know, we can go from our in vitro into quantified data, and we showed so little of the actual data that we get out of these in hours. And so that pipeline is so fast for us that we haven't needed to do a lot of the cell profiler studies, but we can do that. You can use AI. I've always initially I avoided it because I was worried about publication, you know, how do you reproduce it? How do you show what those methods are? I think those barriers are going away a little bit, but you know, here we've got a pretty robust assay, so it hasn't been as much of an issue.
Great.
That's a
Thank you,
great
Brian.
question.
Yeah, good question. Thank you again, Brian. At this time, let's go ahead and move to our next speaker.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. John Chorover. John is a professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Associate Dean for Research in the College of Agriculture, Life, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Arizona. His research group explores the biogeochemistry of soil, sediment, and water through laboratory and field-based experiments, probed with advanced analytical chemistry techniques. Today, John's going to share his work around legacy mine tailings in the Western U.S. as potential sources for ingestion exposure to airborne arsenic-bearing particulate matter. So Dr. Chorover will discuss the transformation of these the arsenic-bearing particulate matter and the associated impacts on bioaccessibility, including how his team utilized a set of molecular spectroscopy analyses coupled to in vitro bioassays. So welcome, John. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Thanks to the NIEHS Superfund program for the opportunity to present in today's webinar. As Chris mentioned, I'm an environmental biogeochemist in the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona, and I'm affiliated with the University of Arizona Superfund Research Center. I am an environmental scientist, so this will be more of an environmental talk. And the title is Transformation of Arsenic-Bearing Particulate Matter and Associated Impacts on Bioaccessibility. So our Superfund research center is associated and focused with the human health risk associated with sulfide ore-derived mine tailings. So these are mineral waste products that accumulate and are deposited on the landscape as a result of mining. They're very prevalent and common throughout the Western US. And these tailings generally remain devoid of vegetation for decades that following the mining cessation and their deposition in the landscape. And so this results in weathering reactions that promote the formation of fine-grained particulate matter. And these fine-grained particulate matter sequester metals and metalloids. And so there's several potential routes of human exposure to the toxic metals that they contain, including groundwater contamination, as well as aerosolized dust, or geodust, as you can see here, that gives rise to inhalation and ingestion exposures. And so that's what we're focused on in our Superfund Center. Our University of Arizona Superfund Center is focused on understanding and decreasing these exposures over time. The most important toxic metalloids in these mine tailings are arsenic and lead, which are sort of number one and number two on the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry substance priority list. And the weathering reactions that I'm referring to here are those that occur when the sulfide ore waste are brought into contact with oxygen and water at the Earth's surface. These are ore deposits that have been buried well below the surface that has maintained the exclusion of oxygen and water. And when they're deposited as these sulfidic materials, which are not in equilibrium with the Earth's atmosphere. When these sulfidic materials are introduced at the land surface, they become oxidized through the through flux of oxygen and water into the materials. We usually start with sulfidic material at the base, like pyrite and arsenopyrite in the context of arsenic. And then as you move up through the profile, you get into a more oxic zone that's essentially oxidized. It's like it's rusted. Got precipitation of ferric solids, so iron minerals that are in the plus three oxidation state for iron. And these tend to sequester metals and metalloids quite effectively. And so the arsenopyrite undergoes dissolution. Arsenic gets incorporated into some of these secondary solids as well. And so, in the general sense, the surficial materials are highly distinct from the waste materials that are produced by the mining process itself. And we hypothesized that the specific amount of water and oxygen fluxing through these mine tailings, that is, the climatic forcing, gives rise to variation in the types of products that are formed. So the research questions that I want to talk about today are: how bioaccessible is the arsenic in mine tailings particulate matter? With a micro X-ray fluorescence image on the right shows the depiction of arsenic distributed throughout these particles. How does the environmental weathering affect the molecular speciation of arsenic in the mine tailings particulate matter? And is arsenic molecular speciation or its local coordination and bonding environment predictive of its bioaccessibility in gastrointestinal fluids and also in mouse models? So the approach that we are taking in this project is to collect samples from a climate sequence throughout the Western US, and the locations of these sites are shown sort of in this upper right-hand corner of the slide, that exhibit a wide range in climatic variation, characterized in terms of the moisture index, which is essentially precipitation divided by potential evapotranspiration. So the bluer colors tend to be moister, the hotter colors tend to be drier in these images that I'll show you. And We collected samples from all of these sites, many of them Superfund sites that are sulfide ore deposits containing arsenic. We quantified the relative contribution of these various arsenic molecular species to the total mine tailings particulate matter pool. And we were using X-ray absorption spectroscopy for that purpose, particularly Zanes and XAFs, X-ray absorption near-edge spectroscopy, and extended X-ray absorption fine structure spectroscopy. These give information on that sort of local coordination environment of the arsenic and its oxidation state. And we measured the bioaccessibility of the various mine tailings particulate matters using the IVBA and in vivo methods that I'll describe shortly to simulate gastric and intestinal conditions. So we were focused here on ingestion of these geodusts and how that ingestion may affect the behavior of these geodusts in the gastrointestinal system and release arsenic into the bloodstream. So some photos of the weathering or the tailings profiles that we sampled across the climate sequence are shown here. And as you can see from these colors and the changes in these profiles with depth, there's a high degree of variability in terms of these profiles, which derive from that weathering process. And we know that this derives from both climatic variation and variation in the original tailings that we call the parent tailings that were deposited on the landscape. And those parent tailings are still accessible to us down in the very base of these profiles because they're less weathered than the materials that are at the top. And so we can characterize these parent materials and compare them to what we have at the top. But so what we're focused on today is the surficial tailings that are at the top of these profiles, because that's what's subject to geodust production and aerosolization. And one thing that we've observed is that these fine particulate matter, which you'll see this term PM for short, tends to be enriched in toxic metalloids of concern relative to the bulk tailings material. Many of the data points, for example, here for the concentrations of metals in these materials tend to lie above the one-to-one line when we're plotting the PM50. So this is the 50 micrometer or less particle size, which is ingestible from the tailings material versus the bulk material itself. And so what we tend to see is that there is an enrichment in the PM50 material relative to the bulk. And so that is something of interest and potential concern as those accumulate in the top of these tailings piles. So to assess arsenic bioaccessibility in these different surficial tailings materials, which we're defining as the release of arsenic from the tailings into a synthetic biofluid, whereafter the metals could be transported through the bloodstream to target organs, we're using an in vitro bioassay to assess that. And the specifics of that in vitro bioassay are shown on the right-hand side. And we have two steps in sequence. Specifically, we took biofluids that are simulating those encountered in the stomach and in the colon. And these are quite different chemistries. The specific compositions of those solutions are shown here on the right-hand side of the slide. And they simulate gastric fluid in the stomach, which is oxic and highly acidic. And it contains the digestive enzyme pepsin along with the background electrolyte. And this reaction is then followed by a second step that's representative of the large intestine, including bile salts, digestive pancreatic enzymes, its more near neutral pH, and anoxic conditions. So there's relatively large changes in the chemistry of the gastrointestinal fluids as you move through the GI system, and things that might be soluble in the stomach might be insoluble in the large intestine and vice versa. That's what's being sort of explored here. So, in this slide and in the next slide, I'm focusing solely on the surface tailings again, because those are the most sort of toxicologically relevant particles. And the data points in the different colors represent surface tailings sampled across this climate sequence with increasing water flux going from hot colors to cool colors, red to blue. And the impacts of climate are quite complex. And so I'm not going to go into detail on those effects at this time, but rather to focus on speciation effects on bioaccessibility. So the left side of the graph shows that the bioaccessible pool tends to increase with total arsenic, but in a nonlinear fashion, with the bioaccessible fraction ranging from near zero in some cases to about 40%, depending on the site that we're looking at. The right side of the graph shows that there's a correlation between the arsenic fraction solubilized in the two sequential extraction steps in the bioaccessibility assay. That is, in the second intestinal step, we're getting a smaller amount of arsenic out, but it's consistently a significant fraction, and it equals around 22% of the arsenic mass that's released in the gastric fluid of the stomach simulant. So in summary, we're seeing large variations across the sites. I mean, these are very reproducible numbers within sites, but large variations across the sites in terms of the bioaccessible fraction of arsenic. And the influence of this weathering process, or the difference between the deep parent materials and the superficial weathered materials on arsenic bioaccessibility, can be explored a variety of ways, but simply by comparing the total gastric bioaccessibility and the surface tailings, which are shown on the y-axis here, against the deeper tailings in the profile that we refer to as the parent tailings. So this is again the fraction or percentage of arsenic that's bioaccessible. And in many cases, despite the fact that we observe an increase in the concentration of metal and metalloids in the secondary products, these fine grain particulates, and that these get concentrated in the surface tailings, we find that the geochemical transformations that are associated with weathering frequently result in a decrease in the bioaccessible fraction of arsenic, but not always. For example, this is quite a different story over here for the Keating site, and there are reasons for that. But this raises the important question of specifically what these alterations are at the molecular scale and how they control bioaccessibility. So each of these mine tailing samples is composed of arsenic atoms that are situated in a mixture of a few to several local coordination environments, as depicted in this slide. The arsenic atoms are shown in red here. The host minerals in the original parent tailings are sulfides, like the pyrite and arsenopyrite that are shown on the left side, where iron is in the plus two oxidation state, so it's shown in blue. These primary minerals weather to form the secondary minerals on the remainder of the slide. And as arsenic is released, and in this case, iron is shown in this brown color, it's now in the plus three oxidation state. And as arsenic is released from the primary phase, like arsenopyrite, it tends to be co-precipitated or absorbed with these secondary phases in a variety of coordination environments. And these coordination environments can be detected and probed using synchrotron-based X-ray absorption spectroscopy, including Zanes and XAFs. So probing the arsenic cage in Zanes and XAFs enables us to resolve the oxidation states of arsenic and iron, but also the identity of the nearest neighbor atoms to the arsenic in the samples and the interatomic distances. And those distances and compositions of those nearest neighbor atoms are diagnostic for the specific molecular species that's present. And so this is what the data look like. I just want to show that these are XAFS data for the surface materials, the arsenic K-edge XAFS for the surface materials on the left, and for the deep materials on the right, and then a series of references that we're using to fit the unknowns, essentially, which are the black lines in both the left and right panels. And the data fits are the red lines shown on top of the black lines. So we're essentially fitting our data to known references to detect the molecular speciation in the samples. And so here, those XAFS data are summarized as stacked bar plots for each of the 13 sites. Okay, and the 13 sites are shown on the bottom of this slide. And for each site, the deeper parent sample is essentially shown right next to the surface sample, which is to the right. So the parent is on the left, the surface sample is on the right. And since there's a lot of information in this slide and time's short to go through it, but suffice it to say at this point that even the deepest samples, these unweathered samples, vary across the sequence of sites in terms of their arsenic speciation. And the weathering processes lead to large changes in arsenic speciation at most of the sites. Excuse me. Whereas arsenopyrite and schwertmannite, or arsenic-bearing schwertmannite, which are shown in gray color in this graph, are prevalent to many of the parent samples at depth. These tend to weather to form arsenic-bearing jarosite, arsenic ferrihydrite, and arseniosiderite that are more prevalent in the surface samples. So we're looking now at the relations between arsenic molecular species detected by xAFs and the bioaccessibility, which is what we're most interested in assessing. And for many of the secondary phases that are important, this is actually a primary phase, arsenopyrite. This is in that parent material. Schwertmannite, jarosite, ferrihydrite, and arseniosiderite. In many of these cases, there is a decrease in the concentration or the arsenic bioaccessibility with the increase in fraction of the secondary mineral that's formed. Whereas in the case of the fraction of total arsenic is arseniosiderite, we see a slightly different pattern. In this case, we see an increase in arsenic bioaccessibility. And in fact, if we the increase in bioaccessibility appears to correlate with an increase in the fraction of total arsenic in both arseniosiderite and in short-range ordered ferric iron phases, including both arsenic schwertmannite and arsenic ferrihydrite. And so that's where we start to see these increases in bioaccessibility. So to test the efficacy of our in vitro bioassays, my grad student Kendra Bonsi conducted a set of in vivo mouse model studies using both germ-free, which had no gut microbiome, and wild-type mice with conventional gut microbiome to test for gastrointestinal bioaccessibility in these tailings particulate matters. And this work was conducted in collaboration with Pavel Kiela's lab in the College of Medicine. And in these studies, we performed gavage treatments where each mouse received an equivalent 40 microgram of arsenic dose in a single oral gavage. And the mice were euthanized 24 hours later by CO2 asphyxiation. And then tissue samples were collected for total analysis of arsenic. And so arsenic recoveries are shown here in a series of bar plots for the gastrointestinal system components, where the different particulate matter species are listed across the x-axis, and the arsenic recovered is on the y-axis. Arsenic ferrihydrite, arsenic jarosite, and arseniosiderite were the solids that we were working in this case. And in most cases, the wild-type mice showed higher concentrations of arsenic in the GI tract, except in the cecum pouch, where germ-free mouse concentrations tended to be higher. But on the other hand, we also recovered a significant amount of arsenic in serum, as well as in liver and kidney tissues. And these results are quite interesting. Transport to these tissues requires dissolution of the particulate matter in the gastrointestinal tract and transport through the circulatory system to the target organisms. And so they're useful measures of bioaccessibility or bioavailability, and they show two things quite clearly. One is a higher concentration of arsenic was consistently recovered in the tissues of the wild-type mice. And the other is that And the wild-type mice, of course, had active microbiomes. So apparently, the active microbiomes are enhancing the transformation of the particles in the gut in the gastrointestinal system, and also that arseniosiderite again had the highest bioavailability as measured on the basis of kidney and liver concentrations and serum concentrations. So. In both germ-free and wild-type mice, arseniosiderite showed the highest liver and kidney recoveries, and that was measured at a single time point at the 24-hour time point. So to conclude, the arsenic-bearing weathering products that form in mine tailings exhibit a wide range in composition at the molecular scale, and this relates to bioaccessibility. And this argues that the total arsenic concentration in a tailings material is not actually an accurate predictor of ingestion risk for these particles because of the particle size and species effects. So molecular speciation exerts a strong control, and that as measured in vitro and in vivo. And some of these phases exhibit a disproportionately high bioaccessibility. The molecular form of toxic metalloid constituents in these mine tailings should be considered in risk assessments of such sites. And I want to thank the members of our collaborative team, the funding from NIEHS, which has been critical at the University of Arizona Superfund Research Center, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Laboratory, as well for the X-ray absorption spectroscopy work. And I welcome any questions that you have as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John. Very fascinating presentation. We do have time for a couple of questions, so feel free to go ahead and add questions to the Q&A box, everyone online. So I'll start off with a question. So it was pretty striking how the wild-type mice showed higher tissue concentrations than the germ-free mice. And you mentioned the microbiome. So can you expand on the your thoughts on the what's going on there and implications for humans?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I didn't get into it in detail because of time constraints, but some of these phases undergo preferential dissolution under what we call iron-reducing conditions or anoxic conditions. And when anoxic conditions are prevalent in the presence of heterotrophic microorganisms, such as those that occur in the human gut, the microbes use alternative electron acceptors to oxygen because oxygen is not there. So one prevalent alternative electron acceptor in this case would be iron. Another would be arsenate. Both can be reduced, and that makes them more mobile, more soluble, and more capable of being translocated into the bloodstream. So reductive dissolution of ferric-based arsenic-bearing particles is sort of our current hypothesis of what's going on with respect to the intact versus germ-free mice. It's a great question.
Yeah, very, very interesting. There's a question asking about bioaccessibility in the lung. Have you explored that?
Yeah, we're actually, that's something that the new Superfund Center that we're in the, I guess, the beginning of our second year of funding. We are exploring. The current project is focused on lung-based bioaccessibility. We've done some initial studies where we've compared lung and lung fluid simulants and gastric fluid simulants, and we find significant differences. In general, the gastric fluid, the pH 1.5 acidic simulant for the stomach fluid tends to be more aggressive at dissolution of many of these particles than something that's more circumneutral and oxic like the lung fluid. But we are just getting into that now. So it's a great question and one that we're very excited about exploring in this coming period of time on the project.
Great. Yeah, very interesting. And we have one last question for you, John. Has any research been completed on lead mine tailings in Missouri?
I am not familiar with those sites. In our research, we focused on Superfund sites derived from sulfide deposit tailings that are representing a pretty wide spectrum in climatic forcing, as I depicted there. That doesn't mean there hasn't been some excellent work done in these Missouri tailings that's being referred to, but I would have to do some literature search to see whether that has been done.
Thank you so much, John. Let's see. In the interest of time, let's go ahead and thank you again, John, for your wonderful presentation. And we'll go ahead and move on to our final speaker for today. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Rebecca Fry. Rebecca is the Carol Remmer Engel Distinguished Professor in Children's Environmental Health. She's the chair of the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering and director of the Institute for Environmental Health Solutions, as well as the UNC Superfund Research Program. Dr. Fry's lab focuses on understanding how environmental exposures to toxic substances are associated with human disease. And her talk today will highlight how the UNC Superfund researchers are deploying NAMs to improve chemical toxicity prediction and reduce reliance on traditional animal models. So with that, welcome, Rebecca. Please feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Chris. Can you see my slides and can you hear me?
Loud and clear, and it looks great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you to the NIEHS Superfund Research Program for the opportunity to present. The UNC Superfund Research Program focuses on protecting communities in North Carolina from arsenic, with a focus on arsenic-induced diabetes. We're concerned because North Carolina communities and many communities around the country are at risk for exposure to arsenic and other toxic chemicals in drinking water, particularly through contaminated wells, private wells. This is a concern in North Carolina as we have the largest population in the country drinking from private wells, with more than 2 million people. So today I'll discuss some of the work using NAMs to understand arsenic toxicity, but we'll share more generally ways that UNC SRP researchers are using NAMs to understand chemical toxicity and mechanisms of disease. And these approaches are helping us move toward more predictive, ethical, and sustainable strategies for evaluating chemical hazards. To provide some historical perspective, I thought it would be interesting to highlight one of the first instances of the use of the term new approach methodologies 10 years ago at the proceedings of the European Chemicals Agency Scientific Workshop that was held in Helsinki. This workshop addressed the use of data and information from new approach methodologies, or NAMs, to support regulatory decisions for the use of chemical substances. Highlighting the interest in this topic, even then, that workshop brought together over 300 stakeholders. And following this, the EPA outlined its roadmaps for NAMs in 2018, defining it as any non-vertebrate animals technology, methodology, approach, or combination that can be used to provide information on chemical hazard or risk assessment. And that includes in vitro tests, in chemical assays, in silico models, and functionally equivalent to what many refer to as alternatives to mammalian testing, as you've heard in the presentations so far today. As I mentioned today, I'll highlight different ways that the UNC Superfund researchers are applying NAMs in their work. I'm going to cover diverse exposure scenarios from arsenic to cadmium to PFAS and wildfire smoke in the context of a variety of adverse outcomes such as autism, developmental and reproductive toxicity, respiratory outcomes, and liver toxicity. So I'm going to share these with you in a series of vignettes. And the first of these will focus on wildfire smoke, where our researchers within the program are asking whether NAMs can be used to better understand the toxicity of wildfire smoke in the lung. Wildfires are increasing across the U.S., so there's increasing exposure to the U.S. population. I'm highlighting here in the figure on the right data obtained just this morning from AmericanForest.org that highlights more than 155 active forest fires in the U.S. today, spanning 57,000 acres. This site also highlights California rating number one in the country for wildfires. And for those of us in North Carolina, it's notable and concerning that we rank in the top 10 worst states for forest fires. This smoke contributes to poor air quality in communities that are near but also far from wildfire, as smoke can travel hundreds to thousands of miles. It's also important to note that wildfire smoke has been estimated to be up to 10 times as toxic as other forms of air pollution. In terms of public health concern, we know that the smoke is associated with a variety of different health effects, from those that are less serious, like coughing, to those that are more serious, like respiratory and cardiovascular disease, and even premature death. We also know that some people, as with many chemicals, are at increased risk of experiencing these health effects in response to exposure to smoke exposure relative to others. So, members of the UNC Superfund research program are working on this. This includes Julia Rager in collaboration with Megan Rabouli, both part of our program, who are using in vitro models to examine how wildfire smoke impacts lung cells. In this work, they're collecting lung cells from human donors at UNC hospitals, and they then expose these cells to wildfire smoke to assess a variety of different biological responses, including protein expression, genomic biomarkers of disease. And by collecting and analyzing those differences in the responses of those samples that are collected from a diverse population, it allows them to understand interindividual differences in susceptibility. So what they're doing here is helping them to understand why some people may experience more severe respiratory effects during wildfire events, which can obviously inform public health strategies, and also highlights how cell-based systems can capture complex environmental exposures in a controlled and reproducible way. In the second vignette, I'll talk about research from my own group that aims at understanding whether NAMs can be used in identifying mechanisms of action of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. We know that PFAS are associated with a variety of different adverse health outcomes, including low birth weight in the newborn, thyroid disruption, harm to the male and female reproductive systems, and pregnancy-induced high blood pressure. We also know that mechanistic data are essential for linking those exposures to biological pathways and informing risk assessment. In my lab, we're using NAMs to identify differential toxicity of PFAS as well as mechanisms of placental toxicity. This work is obviously critical because the placenta plays a central role in fetal development and maternal health, but remains understudied in traditional toxicology. Placental cells are highly relevant, as a result for studying reproductive toxicity. So, on the left, I'm showing you measurements of four different PFAS: PFOS in blue, PFOA in red, PFUNA in green, and PFHXS in purple, in human placentas that were collected from patients at UNC Chapel Hill Hospital, labeled the PTB Biobank. These levels provide data on real-world accumulation and thus environmentally relevant levels. This work was led by a former postdoc in my lab, Jackie Bangma, and represents the first assessment of PFAS in placentas from a cohort in the United States. And the data show that in the US, these exposures that are measured in the placenta are on par with those that have been observed in other countries in placentas, including cohorts in China and Denmark. And on the right, I'm showing you how we measure placental cell migration as an indicator of toxicity. Here we use a specific type of placental cells called SV-NEO. The migration of these placental cells is critical for proper functioning of the placenta. And so any dysfunction of migration can be tied to adverse health outcomes. This work was carried out by a former postdoc in my lab, Dr. John Szilagyi, and we use these assays that allow us to compare and contrast the differential toxicity of PFAS at varying concentrations. So on the right, again, here we examined PFOS in blue, PFOA in red, and GenX, one of the replacement PFAS, which had been identified in North Carolina being put into river supplies. in green. And here we found that Gen X, or this replacement PFAS, displayed the greatest placental toxicity measured through reduced placental migration. So I like sharing this vignette because it highlights how we can integrate in vitro assays alongside human biomonitoring data to better understand how exposures translate into these adverse effects during pregnancy. So, taken together, these NAM approaches highlight that PFAS accumulate in the human placenta and are associated with altered placental migration, providing a potential mechanistic link to the adverse pregnancy outcomes that we see in relation to PFAS exposure. And these findings also really underscore the importance of evaluating PFAS impacts during early development. I've highlighted so far work in lung cells and placental cells. And in this third vignette, I'll share work from the Rager lab that focuses on PFAS exposure and liver toxicity. This work is relevant as PFAS have been associated with liver damage and toxicity, including non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So, in the next slide, I'm sharing with you that work from a former graduate student, Celeste Carberry, who examined the effects of PFAS exposure on the expression of microRNAs in extracellular vesicles that were secreted from HepG2 liver cells. MicroRNAs are critical epigenetic signaling molecules that powerfully control gene expression in cells. So on the left, you're seeing a volcano plot illustrating microRNA expression changes in extracellular vesicles that were secreted from these HepG2 cells after exposure to a mixture of PFAS, including PFOA, and PFHXA. And so here, green indicates microRNAs with increased expression after exposure, and blue indicates microRNAs with decreased expression. Among the microRNAs that Celeste identified to have altered expression in relation to PFAS was microRNA 30E, which is established to play a role in wound healing and cancer. And these findings suggest and highlight that PFAS can disrupt key epigenetic regulatory networks that are involved in cell communication and stress response. On the right, I'm also highlighting one of the exciting findings from Celeste's work that showed that in addition to the microRNA changes in the extracellular vesicles, she also found that PFAS accumulated within the extracellular vesicles. So this raises the possibility that these circulating vesicles could act as chemical carriers spreading PFAS-related signals throughout the body. Together, these data show that PFAS alter microRNA expression, these key epigenetic regulators, and accumulate in extracellular vesicles capable of transporting both the signals but also the chemical from one cell to another, pointing to a novel mechanism by which PFAS may exert systemic biological effects beyond their initial site of exposure. In the fourth vignette, I'm going to highlight that in the same way that we can examine developmental and reproductive toxicity in relation to PFAS, we can also use NAMs to examine the effect of exposure to inorganic arsenic or cadmium. In terms of public health significance, exposure to arsenic during pregnancy has been associated with lower birth weight in neonates, and prenatal cadmium exposure has been associated with increased risk for preeclampsia. So we've assessed the effects of inorganic arsenic on placental cells. This work was carried out by Cassie Meakin, prior graduate student in the lab. On the left, I'm showing you the effects of arsenic exposure on JEG3 placental cells. Here, we're looking and showing that increased concentrations of arsenic were associated with a reduction in the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor, which is a key nuclear transcription factor involved in endocrine signaling. And on the right, you see a graphic from the same article from Meakin et al. depicting seven different key aspects of signaling within the GR pathway that were tested in the study. This study highlighted various ways that arsenic may impact the placenta and modify endocrine pathway signaling. Similarly, we've also examined the genomic effects of cadmium exposure in JEG3 placental cells, as well as comparing these to placentas that were obtained from women with or without preeclampsia. Recall that I mentioned that one of the epidemiologic associations with cadmium is increased risk for preeclampsia. So in this vignette, I'm sharing with you work from former postdoc Samira Brooks, who first examined differential microRNA expression in placentas that were derived from either normal or preeclamptic pregnancies. Those are shown on the left. And what Samira found was that these microRNAs were enriched for a known role in controlling a pathway known as the transforming growth factor beta or TGF-beta pathway. And so on the left, you're looking at microRNAs in human placentas collected from UNC Hospital. And then on the right, Samira also examined these same microRNAs after exposure of JEG3 placental cells to cadmium. So these results are really exciting to me because they highlight this conservation of responses in placental cells to data that are obtained from a human cohort, highlighting really the power of the cell culture to identify mechanisms of chemically induced disease. So together, these data on arsenic and cadmium highlight how exposure can interfere with key biological pathways that control fetal growth, stress response, and importantly, the communication between maternal and fetal cells. In the case of arsenic, identifying that this does play a role as an endocrine disruptor through the glucocorticoid receptor pathway, and for cadmium through the TGF-beta pathway. For the final scientific vignette, I'm going to cover work that tests the use of NAMs, specifically computational predictive methodologies, to identify genes that may be predictive of later life disease. So, in research that was carried out by a former PhD student, Anastasia Friedman, we used computational methods to identify whether various omic measures in the placenta were associated with later in life disease. And for this, we're using data that come from a cohort that I co-lead called the Extremely Low Gestational Age Newborn, or ELGAN cohort, which is currently part of the NIH-funded Environmental Influences of Child Health Outcomes, or ECHO, program. This cohort comprises children who are all born extremely prematurely and who have been followed for more than 20 years. So this cohort represents a really unique opportunity to examine the association between early life biomarkers and later life health trajectories. Over the years, we've compiled a unique repository of data collected from the placentas of the ELGANs, which includes messenger RNAs and epigenetic mediators like microRNAs and CpG methylation. Using a variety of computational approaches that I won't have time to talk about here, we were able to, through Anastasia's work, to identify genes in the placenta where their expression predicted autism risk that would arise 10 years later, with the control of these genes at the CpG methylation and microRNA level. So on the right-hand side, you're seeing proteins that are tied to each of these genes, pink indicating genes that were under microRNA control, purple genes that were under CpG methylation control, and yellow genes that were under both microRNA and CpG methylation control. So I'm excited about these data because we're using computational methods as a NAM to identify genes that are predictive of later in life health using samples that were collected early in life. And so finally, I'd like to highlight work that we're doing within the UNC Superfund program to train our students in NAMS assessment. So building this expertise is so essential to ensure that our next generation of scientists can apply these tools effectively. Our DMAC, Data Management Analysis Center, is run by Dr. Julia Rager and Dr. Fei Zhao. And one of the outputs of the DMAC, led by Dr. Rager, has been the development of something called the TAME Toolkit. This is an online platform that provides examples of how to tame your data. And the resource helps students and users navigate really complicated data sets to apply modern approaches. The training modules include areas that are central to NAMS assessment, such as toxicokinetic modeling and data interpretation. A specific example is module 6.6 that I'm highlighting here that focuses on toxicokinetic modeling, where in vitro-derived bioactivity exposure ratios can be compared to human exposure estimates to compare toxic doses versus doses humans would experience in everyday life. Anyway, these modules give learners hands-on experience with computational and experimental tools that are really standard in modern toxicology. Highlighting the success of the TAME toolkit, we have data that show that thousands of users are accessing the TAME toolkit, spanning more than 130 countries. So, in summary, I've shared how we're using NAMS, how the researchers within the program are using NAMS to understand the toxicity of chemicals spanning arsenic, cadmium, PFAS, and wildfire smoke, just to name a few, how we're using these to uncover mechanisms of action for these chemicals, using computational methods to predict disease later in life, and how we're training the next generation of scientists in NAMS assessment. And collectively, this work demonstrates the power of NAMS to advance environmental risk prediction and support the reduction of animal model research. So with that, I will end, and a huge thank you to our UNC Superfund research program. And specifically, I've highlighted a lot here coming from my own lab, as well as the lab of Dr. Julia Rager. So with that, I can take some questions if there are any.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your great presentation and for highlighting the many great applications of NAMS at UNC. Let's go ahead and move to the Q&A. Please feel free to add any questions to the Q&A box. So our first question is related to your EV example. So did PFAS accumulation cause the increased secretion of EVs? Or did PFAS from serum accumulate in the already secreted EV?
My understanding, and I don't know if anyone from Julia's lab is on, but my understanding is that the PFAS caused the EV secretion. And then within those EVs, the microRNAs were modified and the PFAS accumulated. So those two different features, the chemical accumulation and the modification of microRNA expression.
Great, thank you. Okay, so you mentioned inter-individual variability in the lung model example with wildfire smoke. Do you have thoughts on what's driving the inter-individual variability? And are you evaluating genetic or epigenetic variation in this model?
Mm-hmm. So certainly genetics can play a role. Epigenetics can play a role. Prior exposures could play a role. And my understanding is that the team, so the Rager and Rabuli labs, will be incorporating all of those facets to try to understand what drives that inter-individual difference in response. We have prior work from my own laboratory that would show that differences at of the baseline epigenome, differences in baseline transcriptome could be predictive of inter-individual responses to chemical exposure. So I'm excited for what they're going to find.
Yeah, very interesting. So I guess somewhat related to that question. So overall, you highlighted several great vignettes on NAMS and work at UNC. So, kind of based on your big picture experience, what do you see as the biggest challenges in translating NAMS data into actionable health protections or impact to humans?
Well, there are several things that will make it complicated. One is that obviously one of the first places that we want to work is the reduction of chemicals themselves. And there are lots of reasons why it's been complicated and continues to be complicated to reduce chemical exposures. I think even with some of the models that we're using here, here I could speak to my own research with different placental cell lines, is that different cell lines will also respond differently, and cells in 3D culture will respond differently from different cell lines. So I think over time, the more that we can compare the responses of different cell lines to what we see to human populations, the stronger the data can be. So I like that vignette where I'm sharing with you the data from microRNAs collected from humans with or without preeclampsia to cadmium exposed cells, where we can see that those signatures are the same. So, I do think that one of the ways that we can strengthen the application of NAMs would be to have data from human populations that we could compare to say, here's a genomic signature that we see in humans who either have been exposed to a chemical and/or have an associated disease. And so the more that we can make that linkage between matching those signatures of what we're testing in vitro with what we see in humans is going to be really important. And then the difficulty, Chris, I think for answering that is often we don't have data from human populations that we can tie it to. And often, even if we do have data from human populations, we don't have longitudinal data. So that's also one of the reasons I'm so excited about being part of the ECHO program as well, where we can look at longitudinal data to understand human health trajectories over time and not simply single snapshots in time.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. Another question from the Q&A. So you mentioned that wildfire smoke can be more toxic or harmful than other types of smoke. Could you elaborate a little bit as to why that is and what sort of cell impacts wildfire smoke has versus other smoke?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons, and this would be the domain of others, not my area of expertise, but I think, like we find with other chemicals, wildfire smoke is a combination of mixtures of chemicals. And I know from analysis that I've done in my own lab with mixtures of metals that you take a single metal and you look at its toxicity, you look at another metal and its toxicity, and you add them together and they're synergistic. And so I think the same can be true and is likely true of wildfire smoke, that you're looking at the mixture's response and the toxicity of the mixture as opposed to the individual chemicals.
Thank you, Rebecca. There's a related question in the Q&A about the source of the wildfire smoke. Did the wildfire smoke studies separate the chemicals from trees and forest fires versus chemicals from structures, man-made structures like houses that might have asbestos, dioxins, and other chemicals?
Great questions. And I hope I'm answering this accurately. If not, I'll hear about it later. But I'm pretty sure that the way that the wildfires, the smoke is being generated within the laboratory where different materials are being burned so that there's control over what aspects are being used in the wildfire smoke exposure. And I do believe that's a collaboration between Dr. Rager's lab, Dr. Rabouli's lab, and researchers at the EPA who have long history in doing these controlled burns where they can control the chemicals that they're looking at. So that's my understanding, is that they are burning specific materials that they can then study how the mixtures of those materials influences the cellular responses. And obviously the power of that technique is that you could really try to deconvolute which aspect of the mixture was having the greatest effect.
Great. Thank you so much, Rebecca. So it looks like we're getting close to running out of time. So, in closing, I would want to sincerely thank all of our speakers today for their excellent presentations and thoughtful discussions. Also, thank you to everyone who joined online. Very much appreciate you being here today. So, to close out, I want to welcome back Molly to go over some final reminders.
Thank you, Chris. So before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Just look under tips, questions, and support. Here are a few ways to learn more about the Superfund research program. The SRP website homepage link was just posted in the chat. I encourage you to check it out and check out the various components of the website to learn more about the program and initiatives. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's Clue-In webinars, please refer to the clue-in.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to follow NIEHS on X, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to the SRP Reskill Learning Listserv for more information about upcoming webinars. And finally, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the next two sessions in our series on January 16th and January 21st. Available on this slide is a QR code that will take you to the webinar series homepage for you to register for the sessions. If you are unable to attend live, an archive will be available shortly after each session and will include session recordings and our speakers' presentations. With that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you for your participation, and thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.